Welcome to these Workstream Tuesday EWG on Housing Accountability, January number 23 on October the 11th at 13 hours UTC. Today we have a pretty packed agenda, and I would like to remind you all to update your statement of interests if you haven't done so. As usual, we will be having the roll call based on the attendance of the Adobe Connect room. And at this point, I would like to ask if is there anyone that is in the phone bridge but is not in the Adobe Connect room, so we could add you to the roll call.
Leon?
Yes?
This is Kavus. I am on audio bridge because I am leaving the area I am now for the airport. So please consider after some time I have to leave and I ask the operator not to redial me. And having said that, Chair, I have asked for a change of agenda. I understood that it was not possible. I don't want to discuss that. However, I want to remind our distinguished co-chair that with respect to the OFAC, there was a note sent to you, and this note was asking for some sort of invitation with respect to preparation of a stress test, and I would like that when you reach that point, which I am not be here, please kindly do not change the situation because that note was agreed unanimously without any difficulty, and the invitation for the stress test needs to be carried forward in order to allow us to maintain our consensus. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kavus. It's noted your attendance on the phone bridge, and it's also noted the note that you sent to the jurisdiction subgroup on the OFAC stress test. That is now on the record, and if time allows, we will, of course, address the issue accordingly, and we'll follow up with both the subgroup and the plenary. So thank you very much, Kavus.
It was not my note anymore. Note was agreed by the subgroup. It is now subgroup note, not my note. Thank you.
Thank you, Kavus. Is there anyone else on the phone bridge that is not in the Adobe Connect room? Good. So hearing no one, as I said earlier, we have a pretty packed agenda. We will be going through the first readings for different topics and second readings for some others, and we would like to very much finalize those items for second reading as we are approaching our meeting in Abu Dhabi, and as we have discussed earlier, it would be best if we could have as many reports published for public comment by when we reach Abu Dhabi. So I will now go to the next agenda item, which is the administration issues. And for this, I would like to hand the floor to our esteemed colleague, Bernard Tukot. So, Bernie, if you could help us out with the administrative issues.
Thank you, Leon. Can you hear me?
We hear you.
Thank you. All right, just quickly a review of our timeline, which has not changed. A reminder to everyone that if a subgroup requires a public consultation, the last possible date for submitting it is today, 23:59, so you can have a first reading at the 18th October plenary. Reminder that the meeting after the 18th of October is the face-to-face in Abu Dhabi on Friday, 27 October. Reminder, there's a high-interest session in Abu Dhabi, and we'll be covering most of the topics, and the rapporteurs should bear this in mind. The session is Monday after the opening session, and we would like to have the rapporteurs for all the subgroups available. Although we're talking about ICANN 60, which is Abu Dhabi, we have to run our standard procedures for ICANN 61, which is scheduled for Puerto Rico in March. Before anyone asks a question, we have asked a question, and currently there are no changes. We are still planning to head to Puerto Rico if viable. Of course, if we cannot, we will change the venue, as we saw with the Zika scare. ICANN conference is well equipped to flip these things around very quickly. But for now, there is no change. Because there is no change, we would need a confirmation that we are to hold our usual pre-conference face-to-face on 9 March. So I guess we would like confirmation from the plenary if there are any objections to holding our usual face-to-face meeting one day prior to the ICANN meeting starting. Please notes raise red X now. Not seeing any, I will consider that the usual pre-conference face-to-face on 9 March is a go. The March meeting is always a little tricky for travel funding because we have to start very early. We're proposing to start accepting applications on Sunday, 15 October, that's Sunday of this week. We would close applications on Sunday, 19 November, 2359 UTC. So that would give just a little bit over a month, but I think everyone is pretty much used to the procedure now and understand how that's going to work. So basically, we will get a bit more than the month. We have to submit the final list to ICANN on Monday, 27 November. Are there any objections to these dates? Seeing none, that concludes the administrative items. Thank you. Leon, back to you.
Thank you very much, Bernie. We kindly ask for you to send us your travel request as soon as possible, and as soon as the period opens for receiving these applications, which will be next Sunday, 15 October. And we will be happy to, as usual, follow the regular process to accommodate those requests. So our next agenda item is the legal committee update. We have pending some questions from the ombuds group that were sent to ICANN Legal. We sent a request for an estimate time for reply for ICANN Legal, but we haven't got any reply on that request as well. So we're still pending to get a reply the questions from ICANN Legal, so there is really not much to update. So our next agenda item is the SONAC Accountability Subgroup second reading of the final recommendations. And for that, I will now handle the floor to my co-chair, Jordan Carter. Jordan?
Thanks, Leon. Hi, everyone. It's Jordan Carter here, sharing the co-chairing work with Leon today. And I don't know if Leon already shared the apologies of Thomas Ricco. She couldn't make the call today due to work commitments. And so this is the second reading of the SOAC Accountability Final Report for the group. Normally, I'd be very keen to hand directly over to Cheryl Langdonor, but she's not on the call today. So I'm going to have a go at handing over to Steve DelBianco, the other co-rapporteur on this group, to take us through. Steve, are you available and willing to do that for us?
Thank you, Jordan. It's Steve DelBianco, and Farzana Badii is also on the call, who's the other co-rapporteur. Since our first reading on the SONAC accountability, we have received no comments or calls from members of the plenary asking for clarifications or edits, and so this would be a good time to let us know if your co-chairs have somehow missed questions that came from those of you in the plenary. And if not, I would ask you, Jordan, for the second reading, what is your desire? That we go through these slides very quickly?
I think so, Steve. Yes, going through the slides briefly will just help people recap on where we're at.
Fantastic. So the first slide up here just recaps the milestones we've had. You recall that in March, you approved our initial draft. We put that out for public comment and consultation. We collected all of those consultations. There were 41 comments by 12 different people. We took all those into account and actually prepared a detailed response to every public comment. And then on the 14th of September, our subgroup approved our final recs for plenary consideration. And there was a red line that I issued on final recommendations versus that first draft that all of you approved in March. So we hope that that would make it very easy for you to see why we would recommend that our changes do not necessitate another public consultation. The changes in that red line are ones that clarify and sharpen certain points and took some debates and resolved those debates in what I think is a decisive manner. So let me proceed to the second slide, and I'll be able to tell you how we arrived at that. Half of the comments that came in, of the 41 different comments from 12 different respondents, simply supported the draft as is. And we addressed most comments by adding clarifications, and there was no support in the public comments. If I could get you to go to the second slide. It's number 7 in the current deck. Thank you. Thank you very much. There was no support for adding a new task for the ATRT reviews. That's the Accountability Transparency Reviews. There was no support to add another task to where those review teams comprised of community members would dive into all of the SOs, ACs, and groups to determine the extent to which they had implemented best practices, or good practices, as we call them now. And there was minimal support in the neighborhood of one supporter for a formal implementation of a mutual accountability roundtable. There was also minimal support, only one, for applying the independent review process, or IRP, to activities, actions, and inactions of SOs and ACs. There were, as usual, several comments that were well outside the scope, and we reacted accordingly. Next slide, please. We have three tracks, as dictated by the bylaws that came out of Workstream 1, transitional bylaws. And track one was the assignment to review and develop recommendations so that SOs and ACs could improve their processes for accountability, transparency, and participation. So the main changes we made from our March report was changing the word best practices to good practices. And this may seem trivial, but it was intentional. Intentional so that good practices don't imply that that we guarantee they are the very best ever, since many SOs and ACs may have practices that actually suit them very well, given the way they are organized, given the community that they represent. So what might be best for the ALAC might not be all best for the business constituency. So good practices is meant to drop that bar down a bit. We have 29 recommendations now for good practices. That's 4 more than we had in March. And we've clarified that none of the groups or ACs and SOs are required to implement good practices. The text is very specific that these practices should be considered for implementation to the extent that they are an improvement on the current practices used by SOs, ACs, and groups. And we clarify further that the judgment on whether they're an improvement is up to the SOAC group itself. We also added that the organizational reviews that are done every 5 years, these are ones that ICANN triggers for the bylaws, they're done by outside consultants, and we suggest that they could include an assessment of good practice implementation by the SO or AC that they happen to be studying in that cycle of review. Let's go to the next slide, please. With respect to the good practices that we sharpened or added, we added number 6, saying that each empowered community decisional participant should publicly disclose any decision it submits. This is to guarantee that when empowered community, a member like the GNSO, for example, submits a decision on whether to block a budget, that that decision is published, including any description of the process that it followed to reach the decision. This is to increase the accountability and the transparency of those of us in the community that are represented on the EC. We also added, number 7, that links to the SO and AC policies, procedures, and document practices should be available from ICANN's main website. Today, every ACSO and subgroup has some variety of website that it uses to maintain links to its policies, procedures, its current officers, and minutes and meeting records. but they're not accessible from a single place. This would remedy that by having ICANN staff put together another page under accountability, and staff would keep those links current, so they would point to the right place. Next slide, please. We also reworded in the area of transparency. Again, this is still in track one. Under transparency, many of you, registry constituency and others, indicated that we were very confusing in the wording we had on meeting records. So in the original, we talked about notes, minutes, or records should be made publicly available. In the final recommendation, we say that records of open meetings, should be made publicly available. And the records include things like notes, minutes, recordings, transcripts, and chat, as applicable, to whatever extent your group keeps those kinds of records. If it's an open meeting, you should make those records publicly available. However, when you have a closed meeting, your records for closed meetings should be made available to your members. And you may, if you wish, make them publicly available at your discretion. And again, records are defined here. So that was to clarify the difference between open and closed. And you probably recall that in our recommendation, we have five specific examples of criteria that would be appropriate to close a meeting. Things like confidentiality provisions that we borrowed from Michael Karanikolas and the Transparency Group. Next slide, please. We suggested that there was an original recommendation 4 on participation, that members should be able to access meeting records. So I just clarified on the previous slide how we resolved that confusion. We added item 4, and this is new, with respect to term limits. We said that an ACNSO group that elects its officers should consider term limits. So that's a little different than saying that it should implement term limits. Here the word is consider. In all 28 of our other recommendations, the good practices are operational. This one is different because it says you should consider term limits. That's as far as we were willing to go in a consensus fashion. And then finally, if ICANN was to expand the list of languages that it supports, then that support should be offered or made available to the SOACs and groups. This would allow my group, the business constituency, for example, to take advantage of ICANN staff resources to translate meeting records to any of those lists of languages that ICANN supports. And this would make participation by speakers of languages other than English much more able to participate in the BC activities. So that's a new good practice. Next slide, please. And I'm watching for hands. If I see any hands, I'll stop. Track 2 was to evaluate a proposed mutual accountability roundtable. It was proposed in May of 2015 by Willie Curry, one of our outside experts. And this was to assess the viability of a mutual accountability roundtable, and if it were viable, to undertake the necessary actions to implement it. We are not recommending the mutual accountability roundtable for implementation. We also clarified that ICANN's accountability is from the organization, the management and board, to the community that the bylaws designate represent the public interest with respect to the internet unique identifiers. We do not recommend implementation of horizontal accountability between and among the groups that are displayed on the screen. Yeah, thank you, Jordan. That's funny. Next slide, please. This is our final slide and our final track, which was track 3. The bylaws that all of you approved charged us to assess whether the IRP should also be applied to the activities of SOs and ACs. On this, our consensus recommendation did not change at all. We still said it should not be made applicable to activities of SOs and ACs. However, we did clarify the role of the ICANN Ombuds Office and how it can address some of the accountability concerns, the challenges that might arise about activities with inside of an AC or an SO. We did this after consultation with Sebastian Bachelet and with Herb Ward, the Ombuds Office itself, and we said that the appropriate mechanism for an individual to challenge AC or SO action or inaction is through the Ombuds Office. We clarified that their bylaws and charter are adequate to handle such complaints. Now, we did want to note that part of Workstream 2 includes enhancements to the Ombuds role and that is currently underway, and the plenary will be considering those. It's hoped that those recommendations will further strengthen the ability of the Ombuds Office to address accountability, transparency, and participation within ACs and SOs themselves. With that, I'm completed the second reading, and back to you, Jordan.
Thank you. Thanks, Steve. And I'll welcome Cheryl Langdonor, who's now joined the AWN as well. Thanks for that run through. Are there any questions or comments about this part of the agenda for this item? Any issues that anyone would like to raise or questions asked?
Jordan?
Caboose, please go ahead.
Yes, since I have to leave and I don't think that there will be any objection as such, I would like to make the following statement, if you allow me. It takes about 1 minute only.
Yes.
I must admit that in my many years of work in the international scene, I have never seen an expert or a participant with such dynamism, enthusiasm, devotion, prudence, diligence, as well as all attentions as Steve Del Bianco. He was chief architect for these very important products, which certainly would contribute to the SO and AC accountability. He deserves a sincere appreciation. The appreciation equally goes to the co-chairs, Cheryl and Farzane, that also devotedly assisted him, helped him, and contributed to the activities to achieve. So I think that the whole plenary should put on record sincere appreciation to these three persons. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, Caruso. And I can only endorse the sentiment. And thank you very much, Fazane, Steve, and Cheryl, for all the work that you've done on this work, navigating it through to where we are today. Nicely spoken, Caruso. Thank you. I'm not expecting to see a long list of hands. So, Steve, thank you for that run through. Pardon me, it's very early in the morning, Ram. Fazane or Cheryl, are there any points you'd want to add before you just confirm the second reading of this? Nope. Okay, well, thank you, Steve, for that run-through, and thank you to the co-rapporteurs and all of the participants in this SOAC accountability track. We'll declare that a second reading completed of these draft recommendations, and we will move on to the next agenda item. Are there any objections to that declaration of a second reading? There are. Put a red cross on your W.
I would just add that we will ask staff to prepare this for public comment.
Oh, great. Thanks, Leon. Yes, that is the next step. Okay, we will move on now to the second reading of the staff accountability subgroup draft recommendation. And I'll co-chair this one through as well, because Leon will be doing some more heavy lifting towards the end of the call. This was updated following the discussion at the last plenary in a couple of areas, but we are heading towards the second reading if there are no objections at this call. So I'd like to turn over to the rapporteur for this area, Avri Doria. Avri, are you ready to take the floor and work us through the small updates that have been made? If you are speaking with us, Sabri, at the moment, we can't hear you. Nope, we've got no audio from Abby. We'll just take another half minute to work out if we can get Avery easily on the audio now. And if we can't, we'll just move on to the ombuds topic and the first reading of those draft recommendations, and then we will come back. In the meantime, just to remind you of the rest of the agenda, we'll do the staff accountability, then we'll work through the ombudsman first reading, do the first reading of the human rights subgroup, which will be the same documents as the 28th September plenary, and a review of the jurisdiction of that recommendation after that. Look, we will do that swap in the order now. So, Sebastian, Leon, let me hand it over to you to run through the ombudsman report with Sebastian, if that's okay.
Thank you very much, Jordan. This is Leon Francis again. And we have the first reading for the draft recommendation of the ombuds subgroup. I think we have gone through this topic exhaustively as with the rest of the topics that we have worked on this workstream too. And I would like to handle the floor to Sebastian Bachelet to walk us through this first reading of the ombuds group recommendations. So, Sebastian, do you have the floor?
Thank you, Leon and Jordan and Sebastian Bachelet speaking for the record. I will go to the change as we already discussed in the plenary, the report of the ombuds subgroup that we will show here the changes made since the last call. And we try to take into account the inputs from the participants of the plenary during the last call in the change we are suggesting here. You have received the full document almost 2 days ago, and if you have comments outside of the change made, I am sure that you can do it also during this call if needed. The first proposed change, we add that the current situation of the ombudsman, the current documents, as we will not change the bylaw, we will not change either the framework of the ombuds office, and therefore all the way he's working today will stay. What we will do with our report and with taking into account the external review inputs, and we will enhance the role and the way of working of the ombuds office within ICANN. And the first one, I don't know if I will read the red part after the we have no bylaw changes. It's also important to note that this do not modify the charter of the Office of the Ombuds, section 5.2 of the ICANN bylaw, or the jurisdiction of the Office of the Ombuds as documented in the ICANN Ombuds framework. I just want also to remind you that you received in the new document, we had a new annex with questions from participants from the group and some inputs from the external reviewer after the review was complete. Thank you. If there is no comment of this on this one, may we go to the next slide, please? Okay, here we I've made some changes and we strike out KPIs in the recommendation number 5, and we strike out in the recommendation number 7 subject to practicality, as it's already was discussed last time, and I think it was agreed, but it's time now if you want to discuss those points to tell us your thoughts or inputs. Okay, if not, let's go to the next slide. And I guess the next slide, it's with recommendation number 8, and the recommendation number 8 could be seen as a lot of changes because a lot of red, but in fact, it's we try to underline each part of what will be done by the proposed Ombuds Advisory Panel. I will read this. This is made up of 5 members to act as advisor, supporter, wise counsel for the Ombuds, and should be made up of a minimum of at least 2 members with Ombuds experience and a reminder with extensive ICANN experience. The panel should be responsible for, contribute to the selection process for new Ombuds, which will meet the various requirements of the board and committee, including diversity, recommending candidates for the position of Ombuds to the board, recommending term of probation to the board for new Ombuds, recommended to the board firing an Ombuds for cause, contribute to an external evaluation of the ICANN Ombuds office every 5 years, making recommendations regarding any potential involvement of the ICANN Ombuds office in non-complaints work based on the criteria listed in recommendation number 11. The panel cannot be considered as being part of the Ombuds office and cannot be considered additional Ombuds, but rather external advisor to the office. Any such advisory panel would require the Ombuds to maintain its confidentiality engagement per the bylaw. I hope you were able to understand me. I saw that Alan says that my voice was fading, and I hope that it's a little bit better, and I will try to speak a little bit closer to my mic. Any comments on that recommendation number 8 and the proposed changes? It seems that there is one comment on the Adobe Connect. It's difficult for me to do all at the same time. Can't it be done by talking? It will be easier for me.
Sebastian, if you want me, I could read Phil Peterson's comment on the chat.
It's better if not just my voice is heard during this part of the call, and I guess changes of speaker will be great. I would appreciate that, Leon, please.
Okay, so I will read Phil Peterson's comment. He's telling us that the recommendation concerning a panel is better, but okay to he's telling us that he's okay with most of the points. I'm not going to repeat them, but he's also making a remark that he seems to see no need for a panel acting as advisors, supporters, or wise counsel for the Ombuds. Such a panel might undermine the Ombudsman. What is needed is a skilled, wise, and independent ombudsman. So that is Phil Peterson's comment on this recommendation. Back to you, Sebastian.
Okay. Thank you, Leon. Sebastian Bachelet is speaking. And thank you, Phil, for your input. What we have to take into account is that this review, we take the review from the external reviewer with deep knowledge about the Ombuds in different organizations. And they come to this proposal because of ICANN and because of the knowledge. Therefore, we think as a subgroup that this is a very important point to be taken into account, and that we need to stick with the recommendation of the external reviewer. And this need, it's not to say that the ombuds will be a bad ombuds, or the board will be a bad board, or the committee will be bad, but to have this link and better work and the help from people with a good knowledge of what is the ombuds world, this is why we have had this proposal and support this proposal. Thank you. I don't know if you want me to if you want me to add, or if you have anything to add on that, but I hope that my points will answer the question here. May I suggest that we go to the next slide and see the next changes? Okay, that's the last one. Then I will hand over the floor to Leon, please.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. So I see Finn Peterson is also reacting to or following up to your comments. He's telling us that problems are not solved in complex organizations, but by adding additional offices or panels to the organization, and if the tasks for the panel are unclear, it is particularly problematic. And to that, Finn, I would like to point out that as Jordan Carter has pointed in the chat, we do have an expert report suggesting that this does not undermine the function of independence in the ombuds, and that it's the proposed panel is actually seen as an improvement, and presumably this would add to the role of the ombudsman and hopefully improve the overall work of the ombuds office. I see Jordan Carter's hand is up, so I will handle the floor. Jordan, you have the floor.
Thanks, Leon. Jordan Carter here, speaking as a participant in the CCWG, not with any kind of coherent chat on. I think there's sort of different views about the panel and the clarity or otherwise. Where my head is at on this is that we've got an independent review that's been done and a report offered that does include this recommendation. We've got a sort of improved degree of specificity about what the panel would do and what its role is. What we're looking for in this sort of first reading and hopefully a second reading is to approve the content of the report for public comment. So my request, I guess, would be that whether you agree or disagree with this specific part of the recommendation, given that it is recommended by this external review, it would be most appropriate for us to give the whole community the chance to comment on it by including it in this report. I don't think anyone is going to take an approval at this point as meaning that that issue can't be picked up in the public comments and as we come back to consider a final version later. But I really do think that we should include that proposal as it's been amended in this version of the report for first and second reading so we can ask for those community comments. Thanks, Leon.
Thank you very much, Jordan. I know that Jorge Cancio is agreeing with Finn on the Adobe Connect Room chat. And we have also some comments from Farsani Vadi in the sense that it won't undermine and it would just bring oversight to the ombuds office. So I'd like
the suggestion that you just made, Jordan, I would kindly ask that we conclude this first reading and leave the recommendation as they are, so that we can have broader participation from the community in the public comment and see how it goes with this recommendation. We received the feedback on that from the wider community, and we conclude with this first reading. So are there any objections to approve this as the first reading for these recommendations of the Ombuds Group? Good. So seeing none, this concludes the first reading, and we will continue the process on these recommendations and publish for public comment, and we'll have the second reading in our next next meeting. So that concludes this agenda item, and I will now hand the floor back to my co-chair Jordan, so we can see if we have solved the audio issue with Avery, and jump to the SO and AC, and to the staff accountability topic. So, Jordan, do you have the floor?
Thank you, Leon, and I'm just going to add on that last slide, and thank you very much, Sebastian, and all of the participants in the Ombuds Group for bringing us through to the end of this first reading. I know it was a little bit of a bumpy ride at the last call, but I'm glad we're there today. Turning to that agenda item, this is item 6 on the agenda, the second reading of the draft recommendation of the staff accountability subgroup. I understand, Avery, that we now have some audio for you, so I will make another effort to hand over to you to take us through this update.
Okay, thank you. This is Avery. Hopefully I am being heard now. Please confirm.
You are, yeah.
Okay, thank you. So, and thanks for going back to the slides and for all the help I got getting put back online. So, should I be reading through the recommendations again, or should I just be talking through the points where we had a few minor changes after the first reading in anticipation of the second reading? How would you prefer? I can basically look through the recommendations again and mention when it's changed since the last time, or I can go directly to the changes.
Avery, I think that it would be simpler to just focus on the areas that have changed.
Okay.
And to be ready to invite any comments after that on any of the other recommendations that haven't changed.
Fantastic. Thank you. Okay, so the first change was actually made in the roles and responsibilities on page 3. Let me see. Is that the one that's showing? Oh, no, we... So this is before the slide, and it was just a minor one, but I do want to mention it. In roles and responsibilities on page 3, there had been some discussion in point 7 that reads, in thinking about staff accountability, the most important point is that collaboration is essential to ICANN's success. The community needs to be sure, and this is what was added, when appropriate, that ICANN staff will be congratulated and thanked when things are working well, and also to be sure, and this has also been added, when appropriate, that staff are held accountable through the usual set of human resources. The rest of it remains unchanged. So basically, there had been a discussion last time about the need to add when appropriate in these descriptions. That was done. Okay, now moving on to... there was another one on page 5, and I'm sorry that I'm not in line with the slides, but I want to get all the changes that were made. On page 5, darn. Okay, that is the one that's on the slide page, and is a change to recommendation 3. And towards the bottom of that, basically, there was an issue raised about whether it was a informal procedure or an ad hoc procedure. And basically, the agreement was that ad hoc was the term we should be using, not informal. So that change has been made, and that would be and that is that in this quote, or is that further in this quote on three? But anyhow, that was one change that was made there. The larger change that was made on this one, and it probably is on the next slide, it was the second change, is that begins at the bottom there. While the panel would work transparently, it will at its discretion be able to treat issues that required as confidential. There had been a request then that we give examples, and the recommendation had been made that the transparency team had already worked with the SOAC team. I think this was a recommendation from Steve Del Bianco, who we all congratulate, and basically had been the recommendation that I just pull from there those things. So it's probably on the next slide then. Basically, the list of transparency exceptions for basically treating issues as confidential. And so it was A, trade secrets of sensitive commercial information, B, internal strategic planning whose disclosure would likely compromise, C, information whose disclosure would constitute an invasion of personal privacy, D, one that would harm security and stability, and E, information if disclosed would endanger life, health, or safety of individual or materially prejudice. These were conditions that had been looked at several times before, so hopefully there's no issue with those. Still looking for hands, don't see any. The next change was on page 6, which is, I don't know if it has a slide, but we had had the discussion during the meeting on whether it should be service level guidelines or service level agreements. There had been basically both words had been listed in the text, and basically the decision of this group, the consensus seemed to be to stick with guidelines, and therefore that is what we have done on that one. That was the list of changes that were made. The changes were made. The subgroup had close to a week, but maybe not quite that long given the deadline. And there were no comments or disagreements with those changes in the work group. They are not substantive, but they do reflect the issues and comments brought up by others during the meeting. And I think that's it. I don't know if there are any more slides on this, but I think that's pretty much where we're at. And so hopefully that is an acceptable draft recommendation to send out for comment at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Avery, for running us through those changes. Are there any questions on what Avery's talked through? She did give a bit of a chance for people to ask questions, but I'll just ask that again. We worked through the whole bulk of all of the other recommendations at the last call, and this is a second reading, so we'll be going out to public comment if you approve this at this meeting or if there are no objections. So in the interest of moving us along, thank you, Avery, for your work here and bringing us to this point. Sorry for deserting you as a co-rapporteur in the work a couple of months ago. Thank you to all the participants in the group. Unless there are any objections declared now, I'll declare this as completed second reading for the staff accountability work ready to go out for public comment. Are there any objections? There are none. Thank you. Thanks, Avery.
Thank you.
I will now hand back the co-chairing to Leon Sanchez. Leon will take us through be co-chairing for the rest of the call because I need to leave the AW and be moving around a bit. Leon, over to you.
Thank you very much, Jordan. And now it's time for agenda item number 8, which is the first reading of the final recommendations of the Human Rights Subgroup. And for that, I would like to handle the floor to the rapporteur of the Human Rights Group, which is Niels Den Uver. Niels, could you please walk us through this reading?
I'd love to, and luckily we can walk this time over run instead of run like we did last time, because we got a bit more time to talk this through, and I hope we can finalize the first reading of the work again here. So, just a quick recap, we approved the draft recommendations for plenary considerations at the end of 2016. We did two readings of the document then. Then the document went to public comment. Next slide, please. In the public comment, we got 11 respondents. A majority of them thought that the text was good as was, and there were some suggestions and comments that were out of scope, and some we haven't been able to address in the document and have extensively discussed them and also shared a summary of those discussions here with the list. And it was a decision by the subgroup to not take on comments from several governments, and this generated a minority opinion which was shared. So we came to a consensus, which was not a full consensus, but it was a consensus, and therefore we have a minority opinion added. Next slide, please. It should also be said that the text, as we have it for us, hardly is changed from the last time we did two readings. There are two small changes. One is an addition to this to a footnote, which now reads, including but not limited to, and where it was previously only saying including, and there was a grammatical change. So there are no significant changes to the text whatsoever. Now, please allow me to go a bit more into the detail of the dissenting opinion, and that's the dissenting opinion which is handed in by the UK, by the government of the UK, government of Brazil, and which was supported by the government of Peru and the government of Iran. That they would like a larger, more mention of the UN Guiding Principles for Business and Human Rights. Currently, the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights are mentioned in the document, but these governments would like to see more mention of them. Now, next slide, please. And that is currently where we are. So that leaves the discussion here to the plenary, whether we want to seek to address the dissenting opinion or continue as is, as with the consensus in the subgroup. So here I would like to hand it back to Leon. Leon, please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Niels. And I would now like to ask for any thoughts or comments on what Niels has kindly stated. And to see if there are any comments on the compromise that has been discussed in the mailing list. And I see Jorge Cancio's hand is up. So, Jorge, you have the floor.
Hello. Good afternoon. Do you hear me okay?
We do hear you.
Okay, thank you so much. This is Jorge Cancio, GAC Switzerland for the record. I would like to make this story short and point you to the email I sent today as a reaction to a kind email from Greg Shadden, where we have been trying to work out a compromise solution based on the text I had circulated before the last plenary meeting. I don't know if it makes sense to go into the nitty-gritty detail of the wording. To be very succinct, I have a set on list that I could accept the proposal made by Greg. On the second sentence that I had proposed for the framework of interpretation, where Greg proposes to change it somewhat and include it under the considerations part. And in addition to that, I had proposed, and I'll go directly to my lesser alternative, to include a reference, a factual reference to the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights. The footnote that is on page 6 of the PDF that was distributed, where a list of relevant international human rights instruments are included. So in my opinion, that would strike an acceptable balance. I'm, of course, as I said in my email, speaking for myself, I cannot represent the other governments that were supporting the dissent. But I think this would at least broaden the consensus we had achieved before the public comment period in the subgroup, and it would be certainly very helpful for me internally to also explain to other ministries that we had achieved at least some recognition of the main thrust that we had put into our public comment. Input. So I leave it by that for the moment. And if you want me to read out the text, what exactly looks like, I can do that. But as I said, this is I think quite well explained in detail in the email I sent today as a response to Greg's kind compromise proposal. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jorge. Before going to David McCauley and Greg Shatten, my feeling and my interpretation of what I read in the list is that we do have a compromise agreement on this issue, but of course that is my interpretation, and I would like to handle the floor to the people that are following up on this, which are David and Greg. So, David, you have the floor.
Thank you, Leon. It's David McCauley for the record. And I don't think – well, let me state that my opinion is – my personal opinion is that there isn't agreement yet. But I do want to thank Jorge. I know he's tried very hard to come up with compromise language. I don't support the compromise – for a reason that I believe is very important. And I think in the group there are others that have expressed other reasons for not agreement, and I tend to agree with that. But my concern principally is that in the background, as we discuss this, is a newly forming IRP panel that could address these questions. And so let me explain my concern. The compromise has had two phrases that are important, one saying that the RUGI principles are relevant to this bylaw, and two, saying that the phrase was that they should be considered, should considered. I think we've moved to could consider, which I think is the preferable language. But when we say that the RUGI principles are relevant, we are creating an opening for an IRP panel that would be chosen among people who are independent of ICANN, who may not know about ICANN, to go ahead and create, to start creating precedent around this interpretation. The problem with that is, in my opinion, not all RUGI principles are relevant. And I'll just give one example. RUGI Principle 13 requires businesses to try and prevent or mitigate human rights problems, whether they've caused them or not, coming from their business relationships. And that's not just people that they have contracts with. That's people that are linked to them. And in this case, that would include registrants. To give an IRP panel the ability to make rulings with such a broad definition is an invitation to, I think, get to the content level. And so I think this is a big problem. It may turn out, once the panel's been established for a couple of years, that this would be fine. But when the panel is just getting started and just creating precedent, I think this would be unwise. And so that's the reason for my non-agreement to this. And thank you for the opportunity to state that.
Thank you very much, David. Next on the queue, I have Greg Shatton.
Thanks, Greg Shatton, for the record. And thank you, Jorge, for your response. I'll point out that the changes that I made to the second sentence are almost entirely made to harmonize it with the existing language in the considerations document. As it was originally drafted, it was contradicted the existing language of the considerations document in several places, which is why I made those changes. And the change of insofar to the extent, which according to was made for purposes of clarity. According to my thesaurus, insofar and to the extent are considered synonyms, but insofar seemed ambiguous, as it wasn't clear as whether it meant to the extent or somehow embraced it as a an actuality. So in any case, those were changes made for harmonization and clarity. With regard to the first sentence being put into the framework of interpretation, unfortunately, I can't support that. It doesn't work. The footnote that's there is a footnote of core human rights treaties and the International Labor Organization documents. And it's a footnote to the sentence that says there are a range of international human rights declarations and covenants that could be relevant to ICANN's human rights core value. The guiding principles are neither. This next sentence says, however, none of these instruments has a direct application to ICANN, because they only create obligations for states. That's not true of the guiding principles. Finally, the guiding principles don't create international human rights or define them. They are intended to provide guidance for conduct and implementation by businesses. So they're really different in kind. So those are my core objections. I think ultimately it just does not fit with the concept. It still seems to be an attempt to use the guiding principles as a method of interpretation of the bylaw, which I think is the bottom line problem here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg. And I think that Jorge has a follow-up on this. And he's next on the queue. So, Jorge, you have the floor. Jorge, you might be on mute. We can't hear you.
No, again. Did you hear me now?
Yes,
we can
hear you now.
Okay, this is Jorge Cancia again for the record. So let me try the following. We are talking about two aspects of the proposal that I originally made. So we have the second part of the proposal, which is has now the form that has been by Greg and has been located under the considerations document. So I would understand that as that text now reflects and has incorporated without changes Greg's text, it would be a compromise proposal accepted by all. And I understand that, or I want to understand that the change from should to could means that this is also something that David, although not absolutely happy, would be able to live with. And that's one piece of the proposal. And the other piece where it seems that we don't have an agreement is whether we mention under the framework of interpretation in my alternate proposal the UN guiding principles on business and human rights as one only a relevant instrument of human rights. And here I just wanted to point out that in the footnote alternative that I proposed in my email, there is no text anymore on that says that these UNGPs are relevant for business organizations. This relevant for business organizations, or this relevant for ICANN, that was problematic to David, would disappear in this alternative. So I don't know if that makes a difference for David. As to Greg, I heard that he was saying that the UNGP don't fit well in the list of the footnotes. I think that they do, because in the end they are the international standards for business and human rights. And ICANN in the end has many aspects that liken it to a business. And the UNGP help also in applying the other international human law instruments to organizations like this. So I would think that just the factual listing of this international standard in a footnote of the FOI shouldn't be really a problem. And I have to recall that this is a very important instrument for many countries, and it has been a very strong commitment from us to include this in the framework of interpretation. And by including it just in a footnote without any obligation, without any strong commitment, really, just factually as a reference that there is this instrument that might be relevant, but that is subject to all the interpretational material that is included in the FOI and in the consideration, that this shouldn't be really a cause for any kind of concern or fear from other members of this group. So I would really urge you to consider this factual reference in a footnote part of the package, and so that we could go with this compromise proposal, including the text, as I said before, formulated by Greg for the consideration, which is really the substantive part, and with a could, not with a should, and we could include this factual reference of the UNGP in the footnote or the FOI. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jorge. I would like to remind all participants that we do have a timer, and this timer is set for 2 minutes. We gave Jorge 6 minutes, so that is extra consideration for Jorge, of course. And now I'd like to hand the floor to David McCauley for a follow-up on Jorge's comments.
Leon, thanks. David McCauley. I thought I should follow up since Jorge was basically asking me, and I think he's due the courtesy of a reply. The language that we've been looking at on list in the last several days is the language that I quoted before, you know, the phrase, the principles are relevant and should consider. If I missed the impact of a footnote, I apologize, but my concern is this. I would be, my personal opinion is that we should not, and I strongly would oppose, adopting language that presents an opening to an IRP. I think the IRP would have, should be kept out of applying the RUGI principles to ICANN, at least for now. And the concern I have is the one I expressed earlier. Not all the RUGI principles apply to ICANN. The RUGI principles basically tell a business, if you have leverage, use it to stop these a human rights abuse within your business relationships. And again, that's a very large group of folks. The problem is ICANN is unique, and it does have leverage, including leverage over registrants. And that would pull ICANN possibly to the content level. And I think that the language should be clear that there could be no chance that this language would allow an IRP panel to assert its view of the RUGI principles over ICANN's views of the application of the RUGI principles. If ICANN's discretion is honored over that of what a panel reviewing it might later find, that would be fine with me. I think ICANN should have the discretion here with respect to the RUGI principles, and that discretion should be absolute. Future conduct and future experience with the IRP panel could change those considerations, but for now I think it's just not right, and I appreciate the efforts that Jorge's made, but for that reason I'm opposed to this change right now. Thank you.
This is Afri. I am offline on the computer. Can I get stuck in the queue somewhere?
Yes, of course, Avery. I'll go to Greg, and then I'll jump to you. So, Greg, you're next on the queue. You have the floor.
Thank you. Greg Shatton, for the record. I think my initial remarks explained why the footnote, adding this to the footnote, would be both inappropriate and problematic. Sticking it at the end of a list of core human rights treaties would effectively elevate the guiding principles to the level of core human rights treaties. It would also be factually inaccurate, as the next sentence goes on to explain that those things, which are referred to in the text and then further explained in the footnote, are applicable only to states. That's incorrect with regard to the guiding principles, not applicable to states. So it's just, it's a case of one of these things is not like the other one, or all the other ones, and therefore it just doesn't fit in that place. It also implies that the guiding principles set human rights and define human rights, and they don't. What I would suggest as a further compromise is taking that sentence and that we've been talking about and adding it as a footnote in the considerations section, so that it footnotes the first time the guiding principles are mentioned, so that it does serve as a factual explanation of what the guiding principles are. I think that would be useful and appropriate. Right now, the guiding principles are introduced, but there's no explanation of what they are, and the little one-sentence explanation in the footnote, I think, could help illuminate things for the reader. But unfortunately, I can't support modifying the footnote in the FOI for the reasons I've now stated. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg. So what I'm hearing is that you would agree to add the footnote in the considerations, but not in the FOI. Is that right?
Well, it would not be the same footnote. It would be a footnote that would essentially embody the first sentence of Jorge's explanation rather than just adding the name of the UN guiding principles. But that wouldn't make sense. So it would be to add the sentence that describes the UN the guiding principles, so that the footnote would say at the first time the guiding principles are mentioned, there would be a footnote that would say the UN guiding principles on business and human rights are relevant for business organizations. That way the language would be there, and it would be in a place where it makes more sense. Thank you.
Good. Good. Thank you very much, Greg. Next on the queue, I have Avery. So, Avery, you have the floor.
Thank you. Hopefully I can be heard. Okay, I want to speak to two points. One, I very much support the notion of arriving at a compromise on this so that this report can go forward without the dissenting view needing to be there. My mind is a little boggled at the moment at the back and forth on wordsmithing, but I'm really hoping that Greg and Jorge et al. Can come up with a set of footnotes, a set of modified footnotes, whatever. What I'd really like to speak about, and I don't see my clock, so I'll speak quickly. What I really want to is take issue with David's point about the panel. The panel is constrained by the bylaws. The bylaws say nothing, you know, the content may not be touched, that we don't deal in content. So to say that a panel with all the rules we're putting together for panels and the constraints, that a panel would go against, you know, the bylaws is something that I can't imagine. So I think that the fear that the fear of these things possibly being considered, all of a sudden throwing us into content, is specifically barred already by the bylaws, and I expect any panel would adhere to those. So thanks.
Thank you very much, Avery, and it does make sense your reasoning in regard to the bylaws and the IRPs, but I think that David wants to follow up on that. David, you're next on the queue. I assume that Greg's hand, is that an old hand, or am I skipping you? Okay, that was an old hand. So next on the queue, I have David. David, you have the floor.
Thank you, Leon. David McCauley again. Just to respond to Aubrey, I think her point's a good one, and I could very easily envision an IRP panel saying we are bound by these bylaws and we cannot go to that content level. My concern is that when we expressly state that the RUGI principles are wrapped into the human rights bylaw somehow, we give them the option of finding something different. And I'm in a second career here. I used to be a corporate lawyer, and I used to do litigation, and I've seen judges and panels make rulings that were surprising. I'm simply saying we're creating an opening that I think is unwise. But I take Aubrey's point. It's a good one. And I do agree the bylaws are very good in this respect. But I think when we mention RUGI principles, we're bringing the RUGI principles onto the table, and that was my concern. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. I see some notes on the chat by Jorge. He's stating that the compromise would be composed by two elements. The first, a footnote for the considerations part, where the RUGI principles are mentioned. The UNGP are mentioned, saying that UNGP are relevant for business orgs. That is the first part. think I heard that with a certain wording could fit in this compromise, if I interpreted Greg correctly. And the second part is that the text formulated by Greg for the considerations could be compromised with this wording. And I quote, the text as formulated by Greg is this, to the extent that I can, the organization is a business, it could consider certain aspects of the guiding principles as a useful guide when applying the right score value to its business activities. So I what I'm reading is that this could be, in fact, a compromise that could take us to finalizing this report. And I would just like to ask if there are any objections to having this as a compromise for this issue. I'm seeing that Greg is typing something. And David is reiterating his concern on what he has expressed previously. And Jobs Kalsingis is also agreeing with David's concern. So what I take out of this is that there seems to be agreement to add a footnote in the considerations part. This would, of course, need to be worded. And Greg is stating that he's still concerned about what David and Job have expressed. So he's hand this up. Greg, would you like to take the floor? 2 minutes, please.
Thanks, Greg Shatton, again, for the record. I guess I'd like to perhaps hear from David or Yulf if there is a way to work with the language suggested for the footnote in the consideration section where we've already mentioned the guiding principles and where we have specific language that kind of, I think, describes how the guiding principles should be looked at, if at all, and does not, I think, sorry, let me begin with a new sentence. The way I look at the concern that David raised was that by adding the reference to the framework of interpretation and adding it along with core human rights treaties, it essentially invited the inclusion of the Ruggie principles in any interpretation of the bylaw, since the FOI is intended to standardize the interpretation of the bylaw. My personal feeling is that that by having the footnote in the considerations document, it doesn't raise the same concern. It doesn't kind of invite the opening of the bylaw and the insertion of the guiding principles as kind of an unwritten method of implementing the bylaw. And so, you know, I had hoped to allay David's concerns with my suggestion. So perhaps can hear if there's any, if my explanation has perhaps been helpful, or if the concern still exists, and if so, if there's anything we can do to allay it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg. And now I have David on the queue. So, David, you're next. You have the floor.
Thank you, Leon. David McCauley again. To respond to Greg, thank you for that. If the language is in the considerations, my concern would still exist. But to answer your question, is there anything we could do? If we could come up with language that does the stronger language that Jorge is requesting, but goes on to explain that this is still solely within ICANN's discretion and not with, you know, language like notwithstanding the foregoing, these will not be presented at IRP or some language along those lines. That would satisfy me because that would leave it at ICANN's discretion and would protect the bylaws pretty much like Aubrey was stating. And ICANN would then be exhorted to, you know, see these as relevant and see them as important. But ICANN, of course, knows its remit and knows its bylaws and would apply them accordingly. An IRP panel is going to be new people, independent. They will be educated about the DNS, but they may not know about ICANN's remit or they may not appreciate it until they've been there a while. That's the concern I was trying to address. So I think, yes, adding new language and saying none of this will ever end up at our IRP would probably work. I'd have to take a look at it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. So I just put a comment on the chat that maybe adding something to the wording of that footnote in the sense of ICANN could at its sole discretion, blah, blah, blah. Maybe we could breach this gap. And I think that could help us move on this issue. Would that be some kind of language that could help us bridge this gap? And I am asking, of course, both sides. Governments and our friends on the private sectors. I see David's hand is up. David?
Thanks, Leon. Just to respond, I think that kind of language would work, but we have been wrestling with pretty precise language the last week, so it may be hard to do it on the fly in this call. Thank you.
I agree. I'm not suggesting that we finalize the wording in this call, but just to find a bridge that can lead us to building this last version in the language so we can, of course, finalize these recommendations. I see Jorge is typing. And he's asking us if we could have the text from Greg on the Adobe Connect. I'm not sure if that is possible. Bernie's is telling us that this would take a minute. So if we could please hang in here for a minute. And meanwhile, I'll give the floor to Greg Shatton, whose hand is up. Greg, you have the floor.
Thanks, Greg Shatton again. And just to respond to David and David's suggestion, while I would have no objection to language like that being added to the footnote, it's my view that the sentence or the two paragraphs that deal with the guiding principles as a whole, to which this footnote would just be appended as an explanation of what the guiding principles are, already adequately has enough language of discretion and conditionality built into it. So I think it's important to look not just at the sentence that I've suggested, that's an adaptation of Jorge's second sentence, but also to look at it in context, which is in the footnote, is in the emails that Jorge and I exchanged on the list. It's really the context that informs the approach that would be taken, I think, by an IRP panel if the guiding principles were suggested as some sort of mandatory lens or even discretionary lens to be used. I think it would be clear from that the statement there is taken as a whole that the guiding principles are intended to be discretionary in the ICANN context for reasons that are way too long to go into. But that is, I think, the background. I'm concerned that adding a second sentence to the footnote really would just restate what's already in the text. That's my view, is I think it's already handled. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Greg. And I think that this is turning out to become a subgroup call, which is, of course, not the intention. And I would then encourage us all to propose, in order to begin tackling issues down, I would like to ask if there are any objections to accepting the overall first reading of these final recommendations, but of course with this minor issue, or this big minor issue, as you want to see it, and give us one last opportunity to try to find a compromise by doing the words meeting of this footnote and this text, and then come for a second reading of the overall recommendations with the enhanced wording for this compromise. And I see Niels' hand is up, so I would like to give the floor to Niels. Niels, you have the floor. You might be on mute.
Yeah, that was, of course, exactly the moment I was disconnected. I'm very sorry. I think what you're proposing, and I just want to make sure that I really understand it, that we have the original text plus the suggestion just agreed by Greg and Jorge, and then what is left up for the second reading is the footnote that we will discuss on the list. Did I summarize your ask for consensus in the call correctly?
Yes, this would conclude our first reading as is, but we would go back to the subgroup in order to let this compromise land safely into the next version or the final version of the recommendation. And that is what I am asking. I'm not sure if I'm providing the message accurately. And I also see that Bernie's hand is up. So, Bernie, would you like to add any comments to this?
Just so we're all clear on this, this would be a first reading of the document with the plenary recommending that we bracket the minority opinion, and we bracket the proposals that have been made, the last proposals in chat. So those things in standard, if we will, international language, the report gets approved in its entirety. Those two things are there in brackets and need further discussion until our first week, but this is a first reading, and we would resolve it at the second reading next week on the 18th. That's, I think, the way we could proceed if it's okay with everyone.
Thank you very much for this precision, Bernie, and I support this way forward. So if there are no objections at this point, we would do as Bernie has just suggested and stated on the record. I see agreement in the chat, and I see no objections on the Adobe Connect room. So thank you very much to Niels, who has led this effort as rapporteur for this group. And of course, thank you very much for all the participants. We have had an amazing participation on these human rights subgroup, not only by the rapporteur, but also by all the participants and members of the subgroup. It is really nice to see this coming to an end with, of course, this very little issue that we need still, that we still need to agree on. But I would really like to comment this gratefulness to all of you for your hard work. So that would lead us to our next agenda item, which is the review of the jurisdiction OFAC recommendation. There has been also a good discussion on the OFAC recommendations issue on the jurisdiction subgroup. I note that Cavus, at the beginning of this call, stated for the record that he submitted a note that seems to have the consensus of the group about running a stress test or designing a stress test for the situation highlighted in said note, which I will not go through or repeat as we have no enough time to go through it all. But I would like to call Greg Shatten as to lead us or comment on this OFAC recommendation that was, of course, sent before time so you could all review it. So, Greg, would you please take the floor on this?
Thank you. It's Greg Shatten for the record. Sorry you've already heard so much of my voice before we even get to this. In any case, the basic point of these recommendations is to look at how I can, as a entity located in the U.S., has to comply with OFAC sanctions and seeking improved, suggesting rather, some improved methods for how it could deal with these. It really breaks down into two specific points. It might be, I don't have any slides, unfortunately. I don't know if we can put up the recommendation itself for a first reading. The footnote that's here, or the text that's here, is a useful note on one issue that came up in discussions, and so, you know, was duly noted for everyone's to illuminate the text that exists. But it's the text that really is at the center of the reading. So we'll wait for it to come up in the Adobe Connect room. That's not it. Apologies. We're looking for the OFAC recommendation PDF. Should be attached to my email of approximately a week ago. To begin a bit, the recommendation begins with background. While for those in the jurisdiction subgroup, we have been well aware or have become well aware of exactly what OFAC sanctions are, that can't necessarily be assumed of all readers in the plenary, much less the public comment. So the first several paragraphs are just a primer or a mini primer on what the OFAC sanctions are and how they work. Most of this was drawn from text prepared by OFAC, and the attempt was to be as factual as possible and not engage in any legal interpretation of OFAC's regulations or sanctions. So at first there's an explanation of OFAC, the office itself, which is the Office of Foreign Asset Control, which is a part of the Department of the U.S. Treasury. Then there's a note as to what persons, people or entities have to comply with OFAC sanctions. And then it would be good to have scroll control. Then there is explanation of covered persons, that is, those who are affected by the OFAC sanctions. So I'll pause here and see if there are any comments on the explanatory text before we get to the recommendation. Yes, it would be good to have scroll. Well, here we have scroll control. Thank you very much. So, as I said, I'll pause a moment. Then there's an explanation of prohibited transactions. And last of what OFAC licenses are. A license is really a form of permission to engage in a transaction that would otherwise be prohibited. It can either be specific as to a specific transaction between parties, between specific parties, or there can be general licenses, which are cover a class of transactions or a type of transactions and a class of persons. So they're broader, but those are made through regulatory action as opposed to a specific license, which is basically an application for permission by the one of the parties. So we, if there's no comments on this, we'll look at the actual issues and recommendations. The first recommendation falls under the heading ICANN Terms and Conditions for Registrar Accreditation Application relating to OFAC licenses. The gist of this recommendation relates to the terms and conditions for applications for registrar accreditation. And that currently says that ICANN, that however, applicant acknowledges that ICANN is under no obligation to seek such licenses. And in any given case, OFAC could decide not to issue a requested license. Our recommendation is to strengthen ICANN's approach in the last sentence so that ICANN would be required to apply for and use best efforts to secure an OFAC license if the other, party is otherwise qualified to be a registrar. Further, we state that ICANN should be helpful and transparent with regard to the licensing process, and ICANN's efforts, including ongoing communications with the potential registrar. And this is due to previous concerns raised at, about a lack of communication and transparency. So this is really the first recommendation. So I'd like to see if there are any comments or concerns with this recommendation. Seeing none, move on to the second recommendation here. Which is, relates to the approval of new GTLD registries. it is really the same issue. The AZB, as it currently stands, states in the past when ICANN has been requested to provide services to individuals or entities that are not SDNs, specially designated nationals, but are residents of sanctioned countries, ICANN has sought and been granted licenses as required. In any given case, however, OFAC could decide not to issue a requested license. So our recommendation here, again, is that ICANN should commit to applying for an OFAC license and using its best efforts to secure an OFAC license for applicants that are otherwise qualified. So it's really a parallel recommendation also with regard to being helpful and transparent. We'll see if there are any comments on that. A third recommendation has to do with applications of OFAC limitations by non-U.S. registrars. This responds to concerns that registrars may be following some registrars that are not based in the U.S. Are nonetheless following OFAC sanctions, and it may be that they are not required to do so. Whether an entity is required to comply with OFAC is beyond the scope of our discussion. It's obviously a legal analysis that has to take place based on contacts with the United States and the like. But several concerns were raised about specific scenarios where this might be happening essentially inadvertently. The first is a concern that some registrars may incorrectly assume that merely having a contract with ICANN while having no other contacts with the U.S. That would be relevant to OFAC would somehow commit them to complying with OFAC. So what we do seek here is to have ICANN clarify that solely entering into a registrar accreditation agreement with ICANN does not trigger OFAC compliance obligation. Second, there's a concern that some registrars, non-U.S. registrars, conceivably could be using or reusing registrant agreements that were created by U.S. registrars and essentially cutting and pasting them into their own procedures and having them state that there's an OFAC compliance obligation, which was true for the original author, but not true for the company that's now reusing the registrant agreement. We were presented as a subgroup with evidence of two registrars that appear to have done just such a thing. And indeed, one of those two registrars actually changed its registrant agreement after this was highlighted both in a blog posting article by the Internet Governance Project and also in our subgroup's work. So perhaps we helped to solve the problem, at least for this one registrar. So we note that that's a problem. We note that while ICANN can't provide legal advice to registrars, they should clarify that the existence of the RAA does not cause them to have a compliance requirement for OFAC, and also to remind them that registrars should understand the applicable laws under which they operate and to accurately reflect those laws in their customer relationships. Any comments on this before we go to our final recommendation? Seeing none, I'll move on. The last recommendation relates to general licenses, which I've already explained. the recommendation here is that ICANN should seek one or more general licenses that would cover DNS-related transactions, such as perhaps registry and registrar accreditation agreements with various covered persons. The recommendation more specifically is that ICANN should begin by making it a priority to study the cost, benefit, timelines, and details for seeking and securing these general licenses, and then that ICANN should move ahead and pursue one or more of these licenses at the earliest possible time unless this study process reveals significant obstacles. Further, if there are significant obstacles, ICANN should report them to the community. And here there's a little bit of vagueness that needs to be resolved, whether we're talking about the ICANN community generally or the empowered community entity. So we need to resolve that one point here. I suppose that if we say the community generally, that includes the option of the empowered community responding as well. So the community should be asked for its advice on how to proceed. Also, if ICANN is unsuccessful in getting a general license, since it involves regulations being passed by the U.S. Treasury, that they should explore other methods to accomplish the ultimate goal, which is to enable transactions between ICANN and residents of sanctioned countries to be consummated with a minimum of friction. Last, sounding a familiar refrain, ICANN should communicate regularly about progress towards securing the general licenses so that there's a raising of awareness in the ICANN community and with affected parties regarding both the issue and its potential resolution. So that is the last of the recommendations within our OFAC recommendation set. So I'll see if there are any comments on this as well. I'm seeing no comments in the chat. I do see one person typing, no hands. So with that, unless the comments in the chat are relevant, I will turn this back to our esteemed co-chairs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg, for walking us through these recommendations. Since there have been no objections on any of them, I would like to thank the subgroup for submitting this to the plenary. And now you are able to incorporate this to your jurisdiction recommendations. So thank you very much, Greg, and thank you very much to all who have worked on these, including, of course, our esteemed colleague, Cavus. And our next agenda item is any other business. So at this point, I would like to ask if there are any other business that anyone would like to raise. Okay, seeing none, I would just like to remind you of our next plenaries, which are programmed to happen on Wednesday, October the 18th, which is next Wednesday, and then our face-to-face meeting in Abu Dhabi for October the 27th, which is Friday, October the 27th. So having done this, I think we can wrap this meeting, and I would like to thank everyone for their attendance and for their work. I think we've made a lot of progress today, and it seems to be coming to the light at the end of the tunnel, and it doesn't seem to be a train heading in our direction. So I thank you very much to all for your efforts and your work, and this call is now adjourned.